Okay, Tokyo, Australia, Germany.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Again, my apologies about last night. Sadly, the upshot for this evening is it may be more of the same. I'll get as far through this program as I possibly can. If I can get 3 hours in, it'll be awesome. If I can't, my apologies in advance. It is the second day of March 2016. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. And if you will pardon some keyboard clacking, then we'll see if I can actually get into the chat room.
Waiting. Working.
Oh, thank you very kindly for the thoughts and prayers, Thomas, over at FYINation.com. I can't tell you how much that doesn't mean to me. Am I going to get into the chat room? Am I really going to get into the chat room? Oh, Java likes me. It really, really likes me. Yay. I'm back in the chat room. Good evening, Devin. Good evening, Jug of Punch. Good evening, Labor Man. Good evening, Little Gray. And anybody else who may wander along in fairly short order to be part of the real-time multimedia madcap zany extravaganza that is the Horn chat room. Yes, yes indeed. You can be a part of it just by going to headonradionetwork.com, clicking on chat room, picking yourself out a screen name and a password, and jumping in and participating in the conversation. That's how that works. We're streaming. I'm on. I know that. I've already been told by Thomas and Carol that I'm on. So, and there's a little gray. I have stream. Yes. I think I've figured out a little bit more of what it was that was getting me down last night. I was wondering if it was going to be, you know, big nasty innards problems, and it is. But after doing exactly what I said I was going to do, to wit, heading to the bedroom, getting horizontal, and checking as election results rolled in, some things began to happen. I began to feel like my eyeballs were getting sort of warm and burning in their sockets, and got a little flushy feeling, and then everything started to ache. I mean, I think the tiniest bones in the body, the little tiny bones in the human ear, are aching, because I know the big ones are. And yet, so this feels really kind of nasty and fluish. I hope to hell it's not. But I'll try to get through through as much of the program as I can, as long as I've kind of got the verve to do it. I will remind everyone that this is, of course, a listener-supported radio operation. We survive. And that's exactly what we do. We survive. Nobody's out there pricing Gulfstream 5s or, hell, Gulfstream the 3/4. And no, there's no pool boy, and sadly, Agnes does not have a masseur. Well, but then again, we're not right-wing media, so we don't get to. So we try to raise $200 every evening. 10 at 20, 20 at 10, 40 at 5, 80 at 250, 160 at a buck and a quarter, that kind. Or 1 at 200, or 2 at 100, or 4 at 50, or 8 at 25, or 16 at 1250. Or 32 at 6 and a quarter, or 64 at 375, right? Yeah. No. Well, okay, I blew it. I'm not the math guy anyway, but it is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn, the day after Super Tuesday. And we've got some prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. You may rest quite assured. oh my, no, we really do. We got lots of fun stuff to revel in. And, because my, insides are in an uproar, we didn't have much in the fellowship hall, just a little bit of clear broth and a couple of saltines and, you know, popsicle for dessert, right? Yeah, I've been studiously avoiding food for about the last 24 hours because it just doesn't seem like a very good idea. No. No, this is prayer meeting Wednesday on the horn. I'm going to forego all all of that stuff, if you don't mind, just because it takes an expenditure of energy to do that. But rest assured that if anybody can make good, clear broth, it's the little old blue-haired ladies down in the basement of the Cathedral of Common Sense there in the Fellowship Hall. Oh, you know, they did let me have a little black pepper and a little garlic in my clear broth. It helps. It really does. It does. So, the purpose of religion. What is the purpose of religion? Honest to God. Well, its purpose is to provide a means of governmental or non-governmental social control of the masses. Because what you can do is you can take the masses and you can say, listen, if you don't follow all our God's rules, our God, who loves you very much, is probably going to kill you and torment you forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And thereby you achieve that goal of social control. It hides, religion does, behind a facade, a big facade. It hides behind a facade of loving kindness and caring. Yeah. Sorry. One other thing. I have received a request from the congregation. It says, Brother Bob, we love you, but if you could announce to the congregation that some of us are heading over to Luby's after services. Sorry, Pastor. We're hungry. Oh, not Luby's. Not Luby's. That's torment. Oh, Luby's. Luby. There used to be some great cafeterias in America. Luby's. I guess they still exist. Morrison's just quit, although they own a Ruby Tuesdays, but it's a far cry. No. Morrison's was good. Britling's was good. K&W was okay. And they all just disappeared. It was at Barber's Cafeteria in Florence, Alabama, and later at Morrison's in Florence, Alabama, where I first learned the joys of a tartar sauce that was not to be found in a bottle or a jar anywhere on any shelf in the United States of America. And I know how to make it. And quick as my belly gets better, I think I'm going to sneak over to Kroger's. See if maybe they've got some walleye there, and do some pan-seared walleye and a batch of that tartar sauce. Oh, mercy. Yeah, Bishop's. I never heard of the Bishop's cafeteria chain. How about that? But how fortuitous. Because we're talking about a bishop here. The Roman Catholic Archbishop of St. Louis has gotten his maiden forms in a bunch over child poverty? No. Over the Roman Catholic sex abuse institutional embedded disaster problem? No. People uprooted from their homes by various forms of vicious warfare? Eh-eh. No. The Archbishop of St. Louis, Robert Carlson, is upset at the Girl Scouts. No, really. I wish I was kidding. But I'm not. He's upset at the Girl Scouts because the Girl Scouts teach girls not to be meek little subservient creatures. He's upset at the Girl Scouts because they endorse Gloria Steinem as a role model for girls. Brooga Brooga. The Girl Scouts teach little girls that when they're old enough to have functioning reproductive systems, it's okay for them to determine when and if they want to have babies. All of this up with which Archbishop Robert Carlson will not put. Yeah, by the way, Archbishop Robert Carlson was deposed a couple of years back in the case, in one of the cases where one of his under-priests, and that probably has a meaning that I don't even want to think about, where one of his under-priests, you know, got caught getting kind of rapey with a little boy. Okay, a lot rapey. Really, really rapey with a little boy. And when he was deposed, this is the clown who was asked, but you did know that it was illegal for full-grown adult priests to have sex with little boys. Well, I'm not sure I knew that was illegal, said the servant of the Most High. Just to prove that we can have an ecumenical coming together, which is probably a phrase I should not use in relation to the Roman Catholic Church's child sex scandal. Franklin Graham, who is in no wise a Roman Catholic and did not have to say a goddamn word about any of this, recently announced, couple of days ago, Monday-ish, the Girl Scouts organization sure isn't what it used to be back when I was a Girl Scout, said Franklin Graham. No, he didn't. I added that last part. How he would ever know what the Girl Scouts ever were, never mind. St. Louis Archbishop Robert Carlson isn't worried about being politically correct in letting people know about it, either. He told church members and scout leaders that the Girl Scouts is wrong. Leaders is wrong? Members is... I wish I was better at diagramming sentence. In their support of transgender rights and homosexuality... that is not aligned with the teachings of his church. The Archdiocese also revealed that a Girl Scout troop in Utah was formed specifically to reach out to transgendered youth, and that the Girl Scouts celebrated the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage on its Instagram and Twitter accounts. How dare they? Prepare the stake! Get the old anchor chain! Pile the faggots! No, they pieces of wood! Because we're going to burn us some Girl Scouts at the stake. Archbishop Carlson is exactly right. The ways of the world are incompatible with biblical values. More church leaders need his boldness in speaking the truths that set those who follow God's... Wait a minute, it's in caps. God's word apart from the rest of the world. I don't know about you, but I won't be buying any Girl Scout cookies this year. Oddly enough, he didn't mention to them a part about Bishop Robert Carlson not knowing, Archbishop not knowing if it was illegal for priests to bugger little boys. Mm-hmm. Yep, right. But there's really nothing that says love like Christianity. Says love. In the recent past, we've talked about a bizarre freak by the name of Theodore Chobot. And Theodore Chobot is a notorious bigot, homophobe, and in point of fact, advocate of murder. Well, it's getting a little weird out there. Because recently, Theodore Chobot began shrieking that Jesus, because he knows, that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, would have gladly beaten homosexual Jews to death. Mm-hmm. Well, this didn't sit well with a couple of other freaks. Peter LaBarbara. I mean, Jesus Christ, if there was ever a drag name. Peter LaBarbara said, no, that's no, I can't go with that. I can't get that far. Or another anti-gay activist by the name of Michael Brown, who is not an 18-year-old guy shot down in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. So when his little boy got attacked, his daddy, Waleed Chobot, who calls himself an ex-terrorist. Yeah, who is it? Ex-terrorist. Yeah, who is it? Jehovah's Witness. Go away. Landshark. No. I'm sorry, I just love that stuff. Waleed Chobot has now put forward the following. How much will the evangelical movement in the United States go to please the LGBT agenda? When Chobot.com posted this video on four homosexual wrestlers who raped two boys, calling for a death penalty for these rapists, it upset one blaspheming homosexual and right-wing watch. These taunted the evangelical movement, causing an uproar with top-level leaders calling on them to denounce Chobot.com. They quickly lined up to show their support and denounce Chobot.com for calling for the death penalty for gay rapists. According to these evangelical leaders, calling for the death penalty for gay rapists, gay child molesters is unchristian. The heavyweights from Calvinist John Piper to Dr. Michael Brown, Peter LaBarbara, Matt Barber, and others were irate at Theodore's remarks. Who controls these leaders? One major gay activist who wraps evangelical scholars around his finger gives himself the blasphemous title as Joe My God. You've been to his blog, I trust. Instead of Christ. When they Twitter him, they would blaspheme calling him my God instead of Christ. The trick stems from when Caesar wanted the Christian world to address him as Kyrios, my Lord, which St. Paul denounced by stating that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. That's from Philippians 2:11. That is, Christ is Kyrios, not Caesar, huh? But now this sodomite blasphemer Joe has become their god instead. Did Jesus kill gays? Nothing was ever said in this silly half-baked article that in the Bible it is clear as the sun. Jesus killed the sodomites. Most modern theologians intentionally overlook and refuse to disclose that some of the best passages of Scripture ever used regarding the Trinity and the Theophany is within the context when Christ completely annihilated the sodomites. Only there's nothing in the Old Testament that says Jesus wiped out the sodomites, and quite frankly, the people to whom the book belongs, to wit, the Jews, might take issue with that. Nope, sorry. No sane theologian would argue that this person wasn't Christ. Because Theodore Shobot, who apparently ate the brown acid, is convinced that the three visitors who came to Lot's abode, you know, that was back when he had a house before his daughters got him all liquored up and fucked him. Because that's what the Bible says they done did. That one of them was Jesus, and the other one was God the Father, and the other one was the Holy Spirit. Oh, God. So Jesus was time traveling and smiting of the sodomites. But there's good news there. Because they're beginning to fight amongst themselves. Which is, you know, to someone of Scots extraction, recognizable in the ancient adage, "Come on now, you and him fight. Let's you and him fight." Yes. Note coming in from Brother Deacon Asa. If the ways of the world are so incompatible with the Bible, why doesn't Archbishop Carlson have some of that Heaven's Gate applesauce and join his Heavenly Father right quick? What's he waiting for? See, that's the part I don't get. It's all going to get so much... Okay, so it becomes a theological problem. On the one hand, everything's going to get so much better, and, you know, here we are down here, live on hay, day by day, pray, and there'll be pie in the sky when we die. But we've got a church to manage. So you can't have all your adherents just going, "Oh, I'd rather go up and see Jesus any day," you know, and et cetera. So you got to tell them that suicide is a sin, and you have to wait and let God kill you, however it is that God chooses to kill you, be it some sort of horrible accident or illness or old age. You just got to wait on that. And meantime, while you wait, you can help to support the church. See how the Dodge works? And it's old tax-free. Right. So we've got, they can't just go and bump themselves off as badly as we might like for them to, Brother Deacon Asa. As badly as we might like for them to. No, really, Franklin Graham, Jesus is just awaiting to meet you. He can't wait. He's itching. He's itching to meet you, and you know how the rules are, Franklin. He can't come down here until there's a perfect red heifer born in Jerusalem and the temple gets rebuilt and all of that stuff. So you're going to have to go meet him, Franklin. Here's a gun. You like guns, don't you, Franklin? You're into the Second Amendment. Go ahead. No, really. Put it in your mouth, Franklin. Oh, and by the way, this being prayer meeting Wednesday. And I've got us a new word. We've got some more schlafflage. Man, if that doesn't just sound nasty. Right. Support the church equals do God's work. Exactly, Gerald. Glad to see your glad to see your theologically sound. Thank you, Ron, in the frozen north where some 8 inches more of snow fell overnight. Ron says, good to hear you this evening. I'm glad to be here for as long as I can be. I chewed up four little 200 milligram ibuprofens for the refreshing burst of flavor just shortly before airtime. But we've got a new word, schlafledge. This is what happens when National Treasure Phyllis Schlafly. Go to the Schlafly cutoff and get out and cut off your Schlafly. This is what happens when Phyllis Schlafly delivers the Jeremiad or an encomium or a homily or a humily or about our sick, sad, sorry, failing, ungodly kitcher. You know, where the baseball players ain't all white like they needed to be back when she got to the World Series between the St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Browns in 1944. The National Treasurer said, in regard to presidential politics,
to win, Republicans need to demonstrate that they care about the average person who goes to work every day.
Well, actually, that was Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III that said that.
Average Americans are tired of paying billions in welfare handouts to immigrants who are undermining U.S. wages.
People should have total confidence and a clear commitment on those issues. If they don't, then they don't have my vote, said Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III.
Our immigration policy has been anti-American decade after decade, and the voters need to know that 2016 might be our last chance to elect a president who can reduce this tide of illegals crossing our borders. Interests of working Americans must be put first, Sessions urged.
And we need a president with the credibility to tell the world that the time of illegality is over. Do not come to this country unlawfully,
he said.
Mm-hmm. And then sipping along at her milk of magnesia cocktail through a straw. You know, that's three parts milk of magnesia, one part pure grain alcohol.
With a twist, goddammit.
She praised Jefferson Davis Beauregard Sessions III after his endorsement of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take back control of the party from the outsiders and grassroots. But we got to be careful of the kingmakers. People like that Paul Ryan, that Yankee who's openly contemptuous of Trump and has little use for Cruz. And that little brown lady, Governor Nikki Haley. What's her real Nimrod? Nimrata Haley there in South Carolina. I don't know what come over them people voting for one of them.
Mm-hmm. She's worried about a deadlocked Republican convention.
If such an outcome could destroy the Republican Party and guarantee a Democratic victory by causing disheartened grassroots voters to stay home and pick their teeth with their toenail clippings. No, and tempting an aggrieved candidate to mount a third party or independent presidential campaign. You know, Donald Trump is the only hope the Republicans have to stave off their kingmakers. I'll never forget sitting there watching the watching the Browns versus the Cardinals. You know what I found particularly appealing was the fact that there were no Browns on the Browns. Mm-hmm. Back when baseball was like it was supposed to be. Absolutely.
And then there's, oh my God, this. There was a National Religious Broadcasters Presidential Forum. Did you know that? Because I didn't. And they invited Mumblin' Ben Carson to come and speak to them. He was interviewed by Eric Metaxas, whomever that is.
Gives you the right to live according to your faith without being harassed. And a lot of people, you'll ask them, you say, what's the First Amendment? And they'll say, separation of church and state. Separation of church and state is not in the United States Constitution. Okay?
Clap, dipshits, clap.
It was a Supreme Court ruling a few decades ago where it actually entered the lexicon. But the fact of the matter is...
No, Ben, you ill-educated meat mechanic. The phrase separation of church and state enters the lexicon in a letter Thomas Jefferson once wrote in response to a letter he had received from the Danbury Baptist, the Baptist Church of Danbury, Connecticut, in which he said the government's, because the Danbury Baptists were worried that since they were a minority sect, yeah, I know, it seems kind of silly looking back that the Baptists were ever any kind of a minority, but they were, especially up in New England among the Congregationalists and the Puritans and the Universalists. And the Danbury Baptists were afraid that the under the new Constitution, the government might be able to persecute them. You know, just for being Danbury Baptists. And Jefferson wrote back and said, no, because we have a Bill of Rights in the Constitution, the government can never pick and choose a favored religion. Religion must be separate from government, and there must be a wall of separation between church and state. And that's where it came from, Mumbling Ben, you goddamn fool.
We must preserve the right of people to live according to their faith. And when our system does things that, in fact, do impinge upon a person's ability to live by their faith, the government has the obligation to rectify the situation. That's why we have separation of powers, because our founders recognized that one branch or another might go off the rail and make a wrong decision. Certainly our judicial...
I don't think that's in the Federalist Papers. Just saying.
Supreme Court has made some very bad decisions in the past. You know, things like the Dred Scott Act, and things like the Obergefell ruling on gay marriage. Way out of whack. That impinges upon the ability of people to live according to their faith. And the legislative branch has the obligation, and as president, I would really encourage them to come up with legislation that protects the livelihood and the freedom of people who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. There's no reason that those people should be persecuted in our society. We also need to recognize why this is such an important...
Now, hold on a confounded cotton-picking minute. I agree. There's no reason that somebody should be persecuted for their religion. Any religion. There's also no reason that anybody should be persecuted for not having a religion. Remember, non-believers are the fastest growing demographic group philosophically in the United States. We're non-believers, unbelievers, atheists, agnostics, free thinkers, we're growing faster than the Catholics, We're growing faster than the Episcopals. We're growing faster than the Presbyterians. We're growing faster than the Baptists. And the Baptists know it, too, because, well, you know, as soon as one of their kids goes off to one of them secular hellhole universities, they quit going to church because they realize that somebody's been lying to them for the, say, first 18 years of their little lives. But persecution does not encompass cake baking. No. It doesn't include making a lovely floral arrangement. Yeah, bless his heart, John Kasuch said, if you're in commerce, do commerce. If you're in religion, do religion. One of the few times, and this is involved the taking of medication, that I found myself agreeing with that millionaire 1%er Republican. But no, Mumbling Ben, what were you saying?
Man and one woman. There's no reason that those people should be persecuted in our society. We also need to recognize why this is such an important ruling for the advocates of gay marriage. The Bible, in both the Old and the New Testament, is pretty firm against their way of thinking. But if you can negate that, then you can negate other portions of the Bible as well. This is the camel's nose under the tent to undermine the Christian foundation of our nation.
Wow.
I don't disagree with what you just said, but the implications of it are chilling. It seems to me that you are clearly saying that undermining Western values, Judeo-Christian values, is not the result of liberal policies, but it is the specific intention of liberal policies. Is that what you mean?
Have I mentioned you might
Yeah,
want to
I believe that there are a group of progressive individuals who have intentionally been trying to take over our school systems, been trying to take over the media in particular, and various areas where they, through their propaganda, can undermine, you know, the principles that made America great and substitute them with their principles. And they have imposed political correctness so that you can't even talk about it while they change the fabric of society. That's what's happened. That's why we've changed so quickly. And that's why if we don't do something about it, which takes courage, we will end up with a very fundamentally changed nation.
Well, I found it interesting. Last night, a bunch of us watched the debate on that screen there on a two-hour delay, and I was shocked by two things. I was shocked by Trump saying what he said about Planned Parenthood. I thought it's one thing to have a moderate or a confused view of the issue. It's another thing to on a GOP stage say that I think Planned Parenthood...
Wait, what? A moderate or confused view? Not moderate and. You're either... If you think Planned Parenthood does anything but prepare smorgasbords of baby out there, you're either a moderate, ugh, or you're confused. Ugh. Because only they have the, you know, received wisdom. Right? Sure. Why the hell not? Hang on here. Let's see if we can get to a little more fun.
Against the abortions, and by the way, that's probably only 3% of what they do, which is like saying, you know, baseball stadiums that, 3% of what they do is hot dog sales, and, you know, it's they're in the business of abortion.
Baby hot dog.
So that shocked me that he said that and that he's so out of touch with what we conservatives believe. But I was also shocked that Governor Kasich said, in effect, that ship has sailed. If you're in the business of commerce and somebody comes to you and says to you, you need to photograph my my lesbian wedding, then you must kind of shut up and do it and pray for them. I have to tell you, I was shocked by that.
I was shocked to hear that.
What do you make of it?
I make of it the fact that many people have been mesmerized by the secular progressive movement, and they have come to accept it almost by osmosis without recognizing what the implications are. I have not.
Osmosis, wasn't he the guy who was a foundling found in a basket in a river and went on to rule the merry little land of Oz? Osmosis, no, give up.
I know fully what they're doing, but that's because I do a lot of reading.
Oh,
and,
well.
You know, I read conspiracy books. I read all kinds of books.
Oh, wouldn't you love to have Ben Carson's conspiracy book reading list? No?
I also read communist books and socialist books. And I know about some of these plans.
You know what? If that man has ever read anything by Karl Marx, I will. Well, I'll be the lost heir to the Romanov dynasty. Okay, how about that? Jesus. So there's Mumbling Ben out there. I wonder if he was reading communist books when he decided to go after his mama with a hammer. I mean, you know, there's a hammer and a sickle in communism, right?
Plans that they have. And a lot of people say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. No, you can look and you can see very clearly what they are doing, how they have taken over particularly the educational institutions so that they can basically change the thinking of our young people, and that's why they're so vulnerable to somebody like Bernie Sanders, who comes along and says free education for everybody, and they
notice how he says that free education for everybody. Well, you know, see, as Steve in New York has reminded us, the upshot, the real meaning of the Obergefell decision is that Ben Carson's going to have to go and get himself all gay married, and as Angry points out, there's more than a few of us who are still waiting for him to come out of the closet because we're pretty sure that he's miles deep back in there. But no one said free. No one has ever said free. Again, I find it very interesting that the free stuff argument is something that begins over in the mouth of Caribou Barbie and somehow has found its way into being a talking point among the supporters of Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. But also over among the right-wingers. Free stuff. Nothing in this world is free. No, we pay for it. But there's a better way to pay for it. And that, you know, that's what Bernie's saying. There's a better way to pay for it. Let's all pay for everybody. Let's all pay for each other's. Let's have a federal government that has the power to negotiate drug prices. Huh? You know, just like other governments do. Let's all pay for each other's health care and bring the health care costs down for everybody. And that way, for instance, when, say, the UAW goes to negotiate its new contract with, say, Ford, a tremendous burden is lifted off both sides at the bargaining table because health care is something you don't have to worry about. You can just worry about how much somebody's going to get paid. And instead of paying, say, $2,000 a year for health care, maybe you'll pay $500 in the taxes that support it. Now, these are not economist numbers, but you get the idea. It's going to be cheaper. But they can't understand that. because they think somebody's going to get something for free, and they live in a world where it's all, if someone has something that's less that they have. But we won't have, I had to get that story in, because we won't have Mumbling Ben Carson, Ben the Hammer Carson, Ben Carson who will cut you, and not with a scalpel, damn it, to kick around anymore. He announced today that he sees no path to becoming the nominee of the GOP. And I guess just a little bit ago, he officially did suspend his campaign. And in that moment, millions of Republicans have lost their only black friend. Well, no, I thought about voting for Ben Carson once. Does that count? Yeah. Ron says, lying bastard, I bet Ben Carson hasn't even finished Joyce's Ulysses. I'll see that and raise you one. I'll bet he hasn't started Ulysses. Yeah, Ron's got it. Ron understands the concept. Government pays, we cut out the various middlemen, all good, right? Oh, shit, I forgot about capitalism. Because, see, capitalism is running out of things to consume. And now, for instance, capitalism for-profit health care, which the Affordable Care Act largely is a subsidy for, in other words, corporate welfare for, it's consuming our very bodies themselves. Well, hope in one hand, Brother Deacon Asa. Asa says, better yet, I'd like to hear Mumbling Ben read some of those conspiracy books to me in an audio book. Oh, God, what I wouldn't give. Well, you wouldn't make it through the first 5 minutes. You'd be sound asleep. If you tried to play it in your car, you'd be on a telephone pole before you knew what hit you. Or what you hit. Angry agrees. He says, James Joyce? Absolutely not. He cannot read long books. He said, by the way, he's a lying son of a bitch. Barbie asks, is it just me, or has America become ever increasingly mean-spirited, hateful, and so righteous, taking a bazillion steps backwards to a time where many people stood in lines for work and food and so forth, and we lived in a time of total unrest and violence? Mark my words, we see where this T-Rump and his supporters are taking us. And you don't want to go there. You do not want to go. None of us do. But my God, don't they want to go? It's a mite frightening, isn't it? Who am I kidding? It's a lot frightening. Yeah, Barbie asks, have we become so fucking cold? Yes. Yes, Barbie, we have. Cold and mean. And don't just sit there and kid yourself. And think that that's limited to the Republican Party. Because again, I note the fact that the at least this is what I'm seeing online, the Hillary trolls are deeply invested in the idea of no, we can't. That's what makes her campaign so depressing. Oh, by the way, It's not just on our side that a toll is being taken. We're not the only ones who are paying a price for this brutal, madcap, misanthropic political season. No. You know who slithered up onto the cross and started nailing himself in? Well, sure. The Beckerhead. That's who.
I read in the press all the time. Have you been reading the stories that I'm hurting his campaign? Have you heard that?
No. Are you really?
Yeah.
You're hurting?
Yeah, no, that's what the press is saying, that I'm hurting his campaign. Ever since I joined.
Yeah, ever since he won Iowa, and then he won Texas, and then he won Oklahoma, and then he won Alaska.
Right.
Yeah, his being Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, anointed future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really long time, his campaign. But no. Only after Glenn Beck joined his campaign did he win in Iowa.
But I've been hurting his campaign. So.
Hurting it.
And you campaigned in three of those four states, by the way. You campaigned in Oklahoma, in Texas, and in Iowa. Yeah.
God, I love his set. I mean, to sit and listen to the mad blather is a special form of self torment. But I love his set. I freely admit it. If I ever win the lottery, I'm building a set just like this, only cooler. With robotically, joystick controlled cameras that'll fly around like on wires, like on an NFL broadcast. Not just cameras pointed at somebody who's talking, but really an interactive video format. God, I love that set. Never mind. Let's get back to meanwhile, let's throw it back to the Beckerhead up on the cross.
You don't have a perfect record, but it's pretty good.
Do you know that I have technically put more money into Ted's campaign, I think, personal money, than Donald Trump has put into his?
Yeah. Right.
Well, as Chris Rock would say, the philosopher, peace be upon him. What do you want, a cookie?
I don't know about that, really. God, what kind of donation?
I think so. Okay, these are the numbers that I understand from Donald Trump, that he has put in about $250,000 of his own cash into his campaign, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. This has cost me about $300,000 to go on.
Really?
Okay? Yes, cost me about $300,000 to go on the road for as long as I have.
So those are
$300,000 out of my pocket.
Those aren't donations, you're saying.
Kind of puts that pissant $200 we try to raise every night in perspective, doesn't it? The Beckerhead and I are about the same age. And I guess we're that middle generation of broadcasters. Some younger, some older. We pass the plate, pass the hat every night and try to round up 10 people or 20 people with $10 or 10 people with $20. I've already done that part. And this. I spent $300,000. And you know what? He probably has. Because he's got enough money to burn a sopping wet elephant with sopping wet $100 bills. Up in the frozen north, Ron says, in my bleaker moments, I would support all these right-wing bastards and bastardettes moving to the red states, and then we'd let them initiate a 50-year trial separation, 10-foot fence optional. Of course, there are some small details to negotiate. How do they treat gays, liberals, etc., that decide not to get the fuck out while they still have time? Yeah. But Ron, hasn't that already happened to a certain extent on a de facto basis? Ron points out there was a news report today that, one, Google reports that the search moving to Canada has jumped by 350% in the past 2 weeks, and two, the Immigration Canada website has crashed numerous times due to the amount of traffic seeking basic information. I wonder if that happens about every 4 years in Canada. Hey, Ron, you've got friends. Can't you tell them to make another overture to the Turks and Caicos to become another maritime province of Canada? I mean, you know, please. I mean, you dropped that. We got another 8 inches of snow last night on me, and I got to tell you, that's tough. That's tough. Yeah, but anyway, back to the Beckerhead suffering.
Yeah, just to make sure.
Those are not donations. No, right? No, I didn't donate. This yeah. This is out of what I've personally lost because I'm not on the job.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that's what it's cost me by not being at the facilities in Dallas. We've lost $300,000.
Hey, well, you know, Beckerhead, into each life some rain must fall. Right? All right. So that's, you know, that's where the religion industry is today. Or at least part of it. Upstanding, Bible-believing, God-fearing, Christ-centered evangelicals. And doesn't it make you feel good? No, not me either. But we've got a lot to talk about relative to, you know, what happened yesterday. I guess I'm kind of funny about this, but I personally am not all broken up about yesterday's results. I think we're still nicely positioned. Why? Well, look what happened. Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton had a big night in Alabama. She had a big night in Georgia. She had a big night in Tennessee. And a big night in Arkansas. And she won in Virginia, which probably speaks to, you know, the Democrats who live up in Northern Virginia, you know, a suburb of the Forbidden City, who are just all eat up with moderation. But there's a little bitty, tiny piece of unmentioned data coming out of Virginia. And that's this. Now, while the New York Times was busy ballyhooing her Super Tuesday landslide, things didn't look so great after all for her. And my God, the New York Times coverage has just been abysmal. They're not even making a game out of objectivity anymore. Last night, I got a note from a buddy, Dr. John. The subject line, and Dr. John is both archaeologist, cultural specialist, and journalist. Dr. John said, nope, there are no more editors left. The great New York Times editorial, I presume, for tomorrow's print, begins thus. The strength of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the Super Tuesday primary contests, evident before the first votes were cast, brings the 2016 presidential race to a point of reckoning. God damn. That's pretty strong stuff. Until you stop and actually practice the art of word knowing. John said, after quoting it, read that parenthetical clause again in light of the beginning. Evident before the first votes were cast. John asks, their strength in the primaries was evident before the first votes were cast? Are you freaking kidding me? I guess we should just quit. Dig up H.L. Mencken's corpse, kick it in the balls, and set it on fire because nobody gives a shit about language anymore. I'm not even mad about the premise of the editorial. Haters gonna hate, dogs gonna scratch. Times is gonna flog the establishment candidate. Fine. But at least state your case with confidence and precision. Which that ain't. So I read it again and again, and no, it makes no sense. The strength... Barbie's listening tonight. I need to do the voice. The strength of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the Super Tuesday primary contests, evident before the first votes were cast, brings the 2016 presidential race to a point of reckoning. I'm sorry, Walter. I know, you just spun in your grave. It ain't me. Evident before the first votes were cast. So I started thinking about, you know, how can we point out how much that doesn't work? The strength of the pastry chef, evident before his first cake was ever baked, brings the craft of pastry chefing to a point of reckoning. Well, that's just stupid. The young pastry chef, never having so much as seen a box of Betty Crocker or knowing which part was the business end of the mixer. Jesus. But I tell you what, there's a toaster out there for Dr. John for that line. I guess we should just quit. Dig up H.L. Mencken's corpse, kick it in the balls, and set it on fire because nobody gives a shit about language anymore. Because that is what we call true. And there was all kinds of this crap all over the place. Hillary Clinton had a stunning day on Super Tuesday. Yeah, boy. That was a serious landslide in Arkansas. Onward to Idaho! I mean, do these dimwits ever even get out in the fresh air and sunshine? Carol said, I thought Bernie did great yesterday. He did way better than they said he would. Yeah, they didn't expect him to win Colorado and Minnesota. So we learned a little something that no one dares to print in the for-profit, in-the-tank, in-the-bag media. We learned that Hillary Clinton can win big in states that don't ever go for a Democratic presidential nominee in November. I mean, she sure nailed the door shut on Bernie in South Carolina, Stan. And that was a sure enough whipping she delivered in Tennessee and Alabama. And hoo-wee, I mean, next week, I bet she's going to open up a can of whoop-ass on Bernie in Mississippi stan and Louisiana stan. Except it doesn't matter. They are never, ever, ever going to give their electoral college votes to a Democratic candidate. To quote Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton, never, ever. Oh, and that bit I was going to tell you about Virginia, I got carried away for a minute. So, yeah, Virginia went for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. But way down deep in the hollers, way over in the furthest corner of Southwest Virginia, not Southwest Virginia, but Southwest Virginia, in a place called Wise County, coal country, as we like to call it, a county that has been awash for 8 years in the Obama war on the Obama EPA war on coal. In the Democratic primary yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders beat Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. Now, you're not going to hear that anywhere else. None of my brothers and sisters in progressive broadcasting are going to tell you that. Probably because it isn't something that seems like really much matters, and it doesn't. Bernie Sanders won both Wise County, 45% or more of which no longer exists, where there is an epidemic of human diseases, and where the coal companies have destroyed just about everything that would qualify as humanly habitable ground. It sits hard by the Kentucky line, and you can crawl up this little tiny winding road where if you get up there high enough, there's a vista where you can look back and see what isn't there anymore. And when you get to the top of the mountain and you start down the other side, you're in Harlan, Kentucky. You know, Bloody Harlan. You'll never leave Harlan alive. Harlan. That's the little corner of the universe we're talking about. And a guy who calls himself a democratic socialist won there yesterday. And yet at the same time today, somebody over at the New York Times said, "This does not bode well for Senator Sanders in Appalachia, among poorly educated white voters." Do your homework, dumbasses. Get your nose out of the scotch bottle for a minute. Last I checked here in West Virginia, Bernie leads her by a 2-1 margin. How can this be? Well, she's not running a very good campaign. She's a bad campaigner. She's an atrocious public speaker. And you know, don't blame me for this. If you go to the New York Times and you read Frank Bruni's column from today, he says the same thing. It's about as close as anyone working for the New York Times is going to be allowed to get to saying that Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton is unelectable. Her unfavorability ratings among all Americans are somewhere around 56% and probably climbing. If, in fact, she is the nominee, she will have the highest unfavorability rating of any candidate that the Democratic Party has ever fielded as the nominee for the presidency of the United States. But there's a lot to be worried about here. Because I want a Democrat to be in the White House come January 2017. I don't want to see whatever that thing is on Donald Trump's head trying to fly away in some angry January D.C. maelstrom. I will weep for my country on that day. Much as Senator Robert C. Byrd said during the furious run-up to the slaughter of the people of Iraq, I weep for my country. Oh, yeah. I'll do some weeping, too. But sooner or later, we're going to have to come to grips with something. When Democrats who are informed, when progressive people who are to a person more informed, when they are in the polling places, when they are in the voting booths, they're voting for Senator Sanders. He was not projected to win in either Minnesota or Colorado, and he didn't just win there. He thumped her. 20 points, 20-point margins in states that can arguably be called blue. Not red state Alabama, not red state Tennessee, not red state South Carolina, but blue Minnesota. Thumped her. She was never even really in it. And don't think for a minute that she didn't want to be in it. She wanted Minnesota and she wanted Colorado. But she couldn't get it because actual progressive voters don't like her. They want a better America. They want an America that will be better for the next generation. As Anthony Conright said last week in our conversation, maybe my generation doesn't want to make it better individually. Maybe we want to make it better for everybody. You know, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton campaigned, and she campaigned hard in Minnesota. She stopped in a coffee shop in Minnesota. And while there, a young African-American woman engaged her over her super predators comment. Now, the audio here is not very good. I'll do the best I can.
And I will have a very comprehensive agenda to deal with a lot of the problems. And I'm very proud to have met the Somali American community and have a lot of support in the Somali American community. a lot cheaper, but in, you know, the young councilman is public. You know what, dear? You have a different opinion. He is a Somali American elected to the city council. I'm really proud of that. So, well, then why don't you go run for something then?
No, I'm working for a Somali American.
Good. Well, good. Good luck to you.
Hey, NBC News fan.
No, I know some Somali Americans, really. One of my friends is a Somali American.
You know what, dear? You have a different opinion. Why don't you go run for something then?
And meantime, her handlers are trying to get their hands on her to hustle her and shuffle her away. Because the optics are not good when young black women keep confronting the heir apparent of what we've come to refer to as the establishment. And she got thumped in Minnesota and in Colorado. And that really, really does mean something. It means she can win when she has an artificial advantage. But she's running out of red states. You know, as Barbie says, what a snob. It's hard not to come away with that. She doesn't like being challenged. She doesn't respond to it well at all. So there's two states with strong progressive voting bases. And she gets humiliated. And yes, as Jack in Shreveport points out, to me, the phrase, good luck with that, is just a big middle finger. What Hillary said and how she said it seemed to mean just that. Dear. That young woman was no more dear to Hillary Clinton than... Why didn't she just call her honey? What happened to all of that, all that pushback against sexism, dear? Right? The angry Indian points out, yeah, I heard this morning. Blacks are still drooling at the mouth over her after the genocidal damage she and her husband did to the African community in the U.S. Well, you know, sometimes it's the white devil you know. But then there's this. Recall, of course, that David Brock, the guy who brought on the onslaught of sleaze against Anita Hill, a few years back he turned over a new leaf and said, no, really, I'm a Democrat now. I repent. And founded Media Matters for America, who have been a helpful tool in keeping track of the vicious, hateful filth that pours like a mighty sewer out of the GOP every day, every minute of every day. But wanting something, because in this culture, nothing ever, you know... Ass gas or grass, nobody rides for free. That old saying. Well, David Brock wants something out of a Clinton administration. Maybe he wants to be press secretary. I don't know. But he wants something. And so, and of course, he's a multimillionaire now. And he went out and bought Blue Nation Review, which he turned into a house organ for Hillary Clinton. And of course, he still heads up Media Matters for America, where Eric Bollert works, and published this. After Super Tuesday, it's time for the press to drop its doomsday Clinton coverage. The time has come for the campaign press to finally pack away its Hillary Clinton doomsday script. Since the new year, much of the Clinton campaign coverage has revolved around trying to detail her weaknesses, stitching together scenarios where she would fail, and just generally bemoaning what an awful campaign she was supposedly running. She's too loud, and everything is going wrong. Well, everything's not going wrong. Apparently, she can really, really put together an ass-whooping landslide in Alabama. Onward to Utah! In fact, the primary season has unfolded in the way level-headed observers suggested it might. Iowa was close. Who was suggesting Iowa would be close when she had a 40-point lead? That was back when Senator Sanders' campaign was just a vanity campaign by somebody pissed off at Wall Street. Sanders enjoyed a clear advantage in New Hampshire. Because it's next to Vermont. That's the only reason Bernie won in New Hampshire. It's not because he's got a message that resonates with millions upon millions of Americans. And then Clinton started accumulating victories. Yes, South Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee, Virginia, Arkansas. She eked out a win that was marred by dirty tricks in Nevada. And oh yeah, last night, Massachusetts. You know what happened in Massachusetts, right? Most states have a law against electioneering at the polling place. Usually it's expressed as being within 50 feet, 100 feet, 150 feet of the polling place. No electioneering. Enter Bill Clinton in Massachusetts yesterday at a popular polling place with a bullhorn. Bill Clinton just happened to be in Massachusetts and thought he would just happen to drop by a particularly busy polling place. Which then, because he's a former president, had to be shut down for 4 hours by his security detail. Sorry. No voting can take place here. Mr. Clinton wants to go in and shake hands. Well, isn't that illegal? Well, not as long as he's not electioneering. And in part of the time, he was accompanied by the mayor of Boston. Upon inquiry, the Secretary of State of Massachusetts office said, "We have received no complaints." Yeah, bet you haven't. Because who's going to cross Bill Clinton? Who's going to look at him and say, "Hey, Buster, you can't do this"? Who's going to say that to him?
"Well, I'm not electioneering. I just wanted to shake hands with poll workers. And my security detail has to shut everything down for about 4 hours for me to do that."
"Well, why don't you wait till they close and shake hands with them then?"
"Well, I can't hardly do that. I'm going to be somewhere else then."
Back to Eric Bollert.
Instead of telling that sober story, the press opted for a far more tantalizing tale. A Clinton collapse, a 2008 repeat. Even when Clinton did win, the press often stressed how her victories weren't really victories. Politico claimed that Clinton was stung by her narrow Iowa win.
She was, because she had shed a 40-point lead.
to a guy with a grassroots campaign talking about democratic socialism. The narrative has been tightly knit. Voters don't really like her. That's not a narrative, Eric Bollert. That's a goddamn fact. She has a disapproval rating of 56%. Now, in a winner-take-all presidential system where you need at least 50.00000000001% of the vote, how does that lead up to winning? I mean, Bill Clinton can't go and shut down every polling place in the country. And I reiterate, I say this because I care. I say this because I desperately want a Democrat in the White House in January. And it's not that she's not going to be it. And even if you work out a scenario, okay, so here's how it works. Trump is polarizing the country. Interviewed on CBS by Charlie Rose, Lindsey Graham crawled out from under the fainting couch where he'd been huffing bourbon for about the last 3 days, long enough to say that that Hillary Clinton's a criminal and she's gonna whomp Donald Trump. This is, of course, also a guy who thought that Donald Trump would never win the first primary. He even went so far as to say, God, yes, as crazy as it is for me to say it, I'll support Ted Cruz if I have to. All to try to keep Hillary Clinton from getting into the White House. Because she's a criminal, he said. But along the way, he made several funnies. He was quite wry, downright risible, jocular even. But along the way, he said that Donald Trump has an unapproval rating north of 80%, with growth opportunity. So here is the calculus of the Clinton campaign's strategy. They're going to run a campaign of who hates the candidate less. And they're counting on progressives, Bernie's supporters, to say, like me, oh, hell. Another election comes around, another candidate, fuck it, and go and take our medicine and go to the polling place and vote for Hillary. They're counting on that. But I'm seeing a ton of hashtag Bernie or bust out there. I'm seeing people saying things like, no way will I ever vote for Hillary Clinton. I got a piece here by Russ Belville from Huffington Post. I won't vote for Hillary because I don't vote for Republicans. And he starts out, and this is a little bit in the way of a slap fight, you know, an internet fight. And he addresses himself to this guy, some guy named Chaz Pazienza, who's part of Banter Media. And these are all, and these have been largely, it's largely a third way bunch. You know, whatever we get, anything but a Republican, and it's not, you know, these middle of the road center right Democrats are. you know, this is what we need. It's all we can get. It's the best we can do. And he writes, over at the Daily Banner, Ches Pazienza called me an idiot. Well, not me personally. His article was about people like me, though, who support Bernie Sanders and will never vote for Hillary Clinton in the general election, no matter who her opponent is, the so-called Bernie or bust crowd. That's me. And, of course, a lot of the members of the Horn Family Community Congregation are also truth seekers who have heard Mike Malloy say much the same thing. And, look, that's your right. That is absolutely your right, and I understand it, too. Because at this point in time, I feel like while I'll keep my word, I'm going to feel like I need to put a duct tape on my mouth, a clothespin on my nose, and a bag over my head to go and vote for Hillary Clinton. Not because I hate her. Not because of Bill. Not because of what she wears or how she sounds, but because of what she represents. Because of the $21 million in speaking fees that she's hauled down. Because of the school-to-prison pipeline. Because of the mandatory minimums. Because of her vote on the bankruptcy reform bill. And because of that blood-soaked, atrocious exercise in horrible judgment that was her vote that wound up in the slaughter of 1 million innocent human beings in Iraq. That. Russ Belville continues and says, the gist of the article is that Hillary will have this thing sewn up between Super Tuesday plus her superdelegates, and she's far preferable to a President Trump. So not voting for Hillary equals a President Trump, and letting that happen means I'm a goddamn moron who deserves not 1 ounce of respect for throwing my little pouty tantrum like a petulant child. Calling me names is a great way to get me to support the Democrat, bro, but a better way is to use reason. I've voted Democrat all my life because I hold progressive positions on civil rights, health care, foreign policy, criminal justice, and the environment. That gives me plenty of reasons to not vote Republican. Now, here's one hell of a list. I don't vote Republican because I don't want to see more U.S. soldiers dying in the Middle East for regime change. I don't vote Republican because they'll put the same mega banks in charge of Treasury that destroyed our economy the last time they were in charge of Treasury. I don't vote Republican because I've always supported gay people's civil liberties, and the Republicans who barely come around to supporting gay marriage this decade are doing so only because the polling now supports it. I don't vote Republican because they keep telling me they need more research to believe cannabis is a medicine. I don't vote Republican because they institute terrible free trade deals that destroy jobs and wages. I don't vote Republican because they support the increase of fracking worldwide, an environmentally disastrous policy. I don't vote Republican because they don't believe America can be like every other modern democracy and provide universal health care coverage. I don't vote Republican because they enjoy and exploit the campaign finance shenanigans made legal by Citizens United. I don't vote Republican because they think a $15 minimum wage is too high, and at best it ought to be only $12. I don't vote Republican because they endorse and approve of NSA's warrantless spying on American citizens. I don't vote Republican because they created and supported the USA Patriot Act that is used far more against drug crimes than terrorism. I don't vote Republican because they believe that the era of big government is over and work to destroy welfare. I don't vote Republican because they believe in being tough on crime to the point of supporting mass incarceration of mostly black and brown people. I don't vote Republican because they use racist dog whistles like calling black kids super predators that we have to bring to heel. I don't vote Republican because they opposed closing Gitmo. I don't vote Republican because they want to cut Social Security or at the very least refuse to consider lifting the income cap on contributions to make rich people pay their fair share. I don't vote Republican because people with net worth that requires two or three commas to print don't understand what people like me go through living paycheck to paycheck. I don't vote Republican because I can't stand privatized prisons and they take lots of campaign donations from them.
I don't vote Republican because if we're not going to have socialism for the poor, why should I support those who voted to bail out the big banks and refused to break them up? I don't vote Republican because they supported the bankruptcy bill that made it harder for poor working people to discharge debt while their hyper-rich friends make use of bankruptcy restructuring all the time. I don't vote Republican because they oppose reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act that would separate investment and commercial banking. I don't vote Republican because they support the death penalty. I don't vote Republican because they vote for stupid things like a border fence with Mexico. I don't vote Republican because they get most of their campaign donations from the big banks instead of typical Democratic sources like unions. I don't vote Republican because they would lock up Edward Snowden and throw away the key. Those are 25 pretty good reasons why we Democrats don't vote for Republicans, don't you think? By the way, you can find this at filmsforaction.org, filmsforaction.org. And here's the thing, every one of those 25 enumerated reasons for not voting for a Republican includes a link where Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton has done exactly that. So I'm not going to say that anybody who refuses to vote for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton is a pissant or throwing their vote away or any of that. If I wind up voting for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton, I will do so because, yeah, she's the lesser of two evils. And yes, I understand that I understand what that implies about evil. And I've got a caller on the line, and I'm going to go there in a minute. Please don't run away. But you know that I am somewhat of a student of history. And I've been thinking lately that maybe, just maybe, we put far too much emphasis on presidential elections. And let me say at the outset that I think Donald Trump or little Marco Rubio, who incidentally won Minnesota, and I think the reason Marco Rubio won Minnesota is because of what is referred to as Minnesota nice, you know, that unfailing politeness that seems to be everywhere you look up in the upper Midwest, in the, you know, Minnesota. And I mean, it's Minnesota nice. And even the Republicans there didn't appreciate the antics and shenanigans of Donald Trump, and they found Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz to just be the sickening theocrat that he is. Steve in New York tells me Chaz Pazienza is a Stephanie Miller liberal. Okay. And so consequently, they went for Marco Rubio and gave him his first state, which is probably just enough to keep him in. And being as how Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, anointed future king of America, got himself Texas, his home state, and got himself Oklahoma yesterday and eked out a win in Iowa, will stay in the race. John Kasich is staying in until Ohio, at least. So that pretty much guarantees a Trump nomination. Uh, Area code 410, if you want to try the stress line, you're welcome to do that. Area code 304-663-4676, 304-663-4676. I've already got somebody on that line. But just to go back to Eric Bowling for Eric Bollert for a minute, carrying water. In reality, nobody is that excited about Hillary Clinton and young voters, women and men. The foot soldiers of any Democratic Party movement aren't coming around, BuzzFeed reported. Days later, Clinton won women voters in South Carolina by nearly 50 points. Shh. Don't anybody tell Eric Bollert that South Carolina is South Carolina. How'd she do with those women in Colorado and Minnesota? You know, the real Democrats, the real progressives, Eric. Okay, sorry, area code 410. I didn't realize the phone had stopped being paired. Try me back just in a second here. All right, we're all connected now. Request of the media. Please take your thumb off the scale. In fact, please take both thumbs off the scale. Eric is apparent, little Elwick is apparently, I'm sorry, that's a back reference to Miss Congeniality, is apparently not reading the New York Times, because the New York Times thumb, well, their whole ham fist is on the scales for Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton. And this thing just goes on and on and on. Making it seem that Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton is somehow aggrieved in all of this, that she is in no wise responsible for her own campaign. Yes, the coverage of Trump has been bizarre, but Jesus Christ, it's the for-profit media. What do you want? Look, a squirrel! We'll be back in a moment with helicopter chase footage of the squirrel. With Action News Team eyewitness coverage. Back to Jim in the Weather Center. So you get the idea. And Ron says, you know, to put it in the West Virginia vernacular, I would vote for a mangy Democratic dog before I would vote Republican. That's just me. And that's where I am. I'm going to vote for Hillary. It's not something I'm excited about. It's not something I'm going to be proud of. But I'm going to do it so that when she starts acting like what we know she's going to act like, when she starts bowing and scraping before Wall Street, those of us who said, hey, you know, we supported Bernie, but we did the right thing, but we told you, somebody has to be able to. What's worse, though, is if she, as I expect, falls completely apart on the and gets her. I can't use the typical terms you'd use of male politicians. If she is resoundingly defeated in November, it will be even worse because I don't particularly like my my moth-eaten purple robe with the frayed appliqué moons and stars and will thee kiss me on the in the dark baby written in glow in the dark paint across the front. I don't like it. I don't want to wear it. I want to be wrong. Oh wow, I want to be wrong. But you know what? I would much rather just have a Democratic nominee that all the polling data says can beat Trump, can beat Rubio, can beat Santorum, can beat Kasich, can beat Cruz, can beat Gingrich, can beat Santorum, can beat Rubio, can beat Rubio, can beat Cruz, can beat Dix. You remember? You remember when they beat up Richard Dix? No, never mind. Another movie reference. That's what I want, and that's what I'm going to keep supporting. But see, they're not happy with that. The Hilarians. If you say anything, I've got experience. I'm going to vote for her if she's the nominee. The attacks keep coming. It's almost as though not even okay to vote our consciences in the primary. And the next thing, this is all going to be wrapped up on March 15th. It'll be over. What? I don't get to vote till May, and I damned well don't appreciate being disenfranchised. Let's run over and talk to Todd. Hey, Todd.
Hey, Bob, can you hear me?
I got you.
Hey, how you doing?
I've been better.
I guess that's just, maybe I was just rhetorical. Anyway, you know what? Let's focus on the positive. Both of us felt very good I felt very good Saturday because just like you said about maybe 35 seconds ago, people have to understand. I don't think people understand. The primary is when you can speak. Don't worry about what might happen. That's when you can speak.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise we had no voice. So that was the good thing, right? That's the good thing. But I'm feeling like the general gist of your conversation, you know, the powers that be, they need to recognize now we are near the end of this era of false choices. They keep presenting us with false choices. And people are fed up. They're fed up on the left and they're fed up on the right. I mean, that's the way I see it.
Are they afraid to have? Look, I'm sorry. I mean, compared to Bill Clinton's campaign, compared to Barack Obama's campaign, hell, compared to John Edwards' campaign, I saw debate footage from 2008 with John Edwards still sitting at the table. I'd managed to completely forget about him, and I thought, you know, you fuckwit. Compared to Bernie's campaign, she does not run. And again, I'm not calling names here. I'm trying to make a point, Todd. She's an administrator. She's a bureaucrat. She's not the kind of lawyer who stands before a jury and has them weeping about the injustice that's been done to her client being brought to trial. She's the kind of lawyer who sits in a corner office with piles and piles and piles of paper and lots of numbers and just does bureaucracy. And we need we need people like that. You know, I don't want an accountant like me. Okay? I don't want a doctor like me. I want people who are happy doing what they're doing. And the thing is, Dr. First Lady Senator Secretary Clinton isn't happy doing what she's doing. She's not happy doing what she's best at.
Okay. All right, here we go.
Did I say something wrong?
Well, no, I'm just have to keep this very clear. I want to be very succinct, and I want to make this. This is very salient. What's going on with Secretary? All right. Now, first of all, she had to go through the seven stages of grief when she figured out that Bernie was going to give her a run for her money, because she was I could see it in her affect. All right, that she was pissed off that she had to work this hard. Right. First of all, and
Todd, there have been a couple of times during the debate pageants where if looks could kill, poor Bernie would have gone away in pieces in a basket.
And I'm going to have to rewind just really quickly because I had to watch this. All right. Yeah, rewind. Let me calm down. All right. Now, the only, in my opinion, and of course I'm biased, but my opinion, the only debate that we've ever had in any camp you're in was the debate when it was just Bernie and Hillary. That was a debate because for some reason, oh, this goes to my second point. Let me write this down. Okay. Yeah, because apparently these moderators know nothing of decorum, because you couldn't get away with this shit in high school or junior high.
Well, they damn sure don't know anything about formal debate.
Hell no. Fuck that shit.
But again, Todd, wait a minute.
I don't even want to get off on that right now.
No. Debate is what we call them. The reason American politics and American elections have become what they are is because of the for-profit media. These things generate millions upon tens of millions upon hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenues. Okay. And it's the same thing. Whether you know, if you're over there on the Fish and Life channel, and you're watching some fella flick his bait in the water, well, sooner or later, they're going to show you a commercial.
But listen, our political system is not the motherfucking Hunger Games,
Well, no, but, it's not the Hunger Games, Todd. It's reality television. It's Survivor. It's politicians of Washington, D.C.
That's a whole other program. What I'm trying to say is that during that debate, this is when I knew Bernie was going to have trouble. Is when this is the first time in my lifetime I ever heard somebody running for office say what we did wrong and say we did this wrong and it was wrong and this is why these people feel this way of us. All right, talking about Iran and Kissinger, he was right. But see, it got quiet and I was like, uh-oh, it's all flat, folks. And these are college students. They don't know what the hell is going on, man. What the fuck? I mean, it's common knowledge now. When I was their age, it really wasn't common knowledge that there's a reason that those people don't like us. You know, when you take some, how would you like it if somebody came over here and said, "Hey, Bush and Obama, get the hell out. We're taking over." I don't think we would like that too much. So, you know, there's history anyway. So when he dropped the history bomb, I'm gonna try to keep it straight. All right, when he dropped the history bomb. Do you know what I'm talking about? You saw the debate, right?
Tell me. I mean, I probably do, but I'm going to need a little more detail.
All right. So during the debate, Bernie, when they were talking about foreign policy and decisions, right, decisions came up. So Bernie said, okay, decisions. He said, well, let's look at the history of why we're in the mess we're in with Iran. And he talked about the United States overthrowing Mossadegh. Due to oil interests, he didn't want to play ball with us, so we overthrew him, the CIA did, so, we took over the oil, so the West could take over the oil market, and that's really what precipitated the students taking hostages in Iran. All right, but it seemed like nobody in the audience knew, even though I didn't know anything about it, even though it's common knowledge now with many people, I mean, it's in history books now. At one point, it was really not talked of that much.
Right. Oh, no. That part, one, I thought that was impressive because Bernie Sanders was able to say the name Mossadegh. More impressive was the fact that he knew what we did. And, did she even respond in that? Did she say what we did to Mossadegh was wrong?
Or did they just blow past it?
Oh, wait, Bernie's talking about that damned history stuff again. Cut to commercial.
But at least they weren't, okay, right. So that's what I'm saying. Bernie is dealing with facts. And now that I'm bordering on crotchety, I understand why Bernie sometimes gets, he's like, just Google my history. I shouldn't have to explain everything I do. Because the black vote is what's pivoting, this election is pivoting on the black vote. It really is. And it's a shame because in the South, these people are still enamored with the Clintons, even though through the history, maybe, it was a good thing at the time because of what people had been dealing with. So it was like a breath of fresh air. Anything was good. Breathe. Give me some air. But now, not so much. But on the other side, the GOP side, these debate type programs, which are not debate. I just thought about this the other day. How is it now, if I had children, I would put me in a very awkward position. Because you want to teach your kids about the political process, but this is not how people should act. And, you know, kids are sponges. Kids are sponges. When they see people running for office, acting like that, when they go to school, they act that shit out. I've seen it.
There's one other thing that I want to make clear in this, Todd. When I talk about her 56% disapproval rating, I'm not saying that she earned all of that. They started building a machine back in 1992 because they took one look at her and one look at Bill, and they tried to stop Bill from being president. And they tried to, they did everything they could during his 8 years. And they made America feel sorry for Bill Clinton. Jesus, he had a 76% approval rating when he left the office. But along the way, they could also see that then First Lady Hillary Clinton was just a boiling pot of ambition. And she is, and there's nothing wrong with being ambitious. But she is deeply ambitious.
Well,
she has a raw hunger for power, and she badly wants to be liked. So what they did, Todd, and I just want to get this finished. What they did is they started back in 1992 building a machine whose sole purpose was the destruction of Hillary Clinton, and it runs. It's a 16-cylinder affair. And it runs on 102-octane pure hate. And if she so much as breathed, the machine was there to pump out some filth about it. I mean, I'll never forget to this day. I've never forgotten when Anthrax Coulter declared to a bunch of mouth-walking, knuckle-breathing goons who hung on her every word that the Clintons decorated their Christmas tree with condoms.
Ann Coulter said that.
Oh yeah. Okay. I mean, it's been going on. It's been going on for half a generation now. I mean, that this filth machine is near a quarter century old. And they've got that sucker turned up to 11. And a lot of it's bullshit. The email scandal is bullshit, but you know. Daryl Issa admitted the only purpose of that was to keep her from becoming president. And you know what? It works. This is a venal and ignorant nation that is hopelessly addicted to the for-profit media narratives that are fed to it, and it works. A lot of that unmitigated bullshit came out of the Clinton hate machine. I mean, Jesus Christ, Jerry Falwell. It got so bad. Jerry fucking Falwell had to distance himself from a videotape that was being sold about all the murders Hillary Clinton had committed. Well, she didn't.
I don't remember that. Are you serious?
Oh yeah. Remember. Oh yeah. The Clinton Chronicles.
I think I started to tune it out because every week it was like they were making up things. I do remember they were making up things every week.
And I forget who the goober was from, I think, Talibandiana, who proudly declared he had taken a 9mm pistol out to his backyard and shot watermelons to prove that Hillary killed Vince Foster.
Well, you know what's interesting, what coincides temporally with that whole, what you're talking about, is the GOP news, or what we call Fox News, right? Because that was Ailes, that's exactly when they got started with that, right?
But a lot of that stuff had already been come out via the Clinton Project, financed by Richard Mellon Scaife, before Fox ever even really got off the ground. And see, the thing is, and it's probably apocryphal, but there's an old dirty politics story that gets told about LBJ that goes back to his Senate days running for office in Texas. And he told his campaign manager, he said, and we'll just make up the opponent's name,
I want you to put out a press release asking, saying that LBJ wants to know if Joe Smith has stopped having sex with farm animals.
Oh.
And his campaign manager said, LBJ, I can't say that. We don't have any evidence. And LBJ just laughed and said, I just want to hear him deny it. Because he understood the power of the smear. And so that's what's been going on since 1992 with Hillary Clinton. And so, you know, maybe people don't think that... you'd be surprised the number of people that think she murdered Vince Foster. But the stuff that was pumped out on the Limbaugh program about, my friends, the things that have gone on at the MENA airport in Arkansas would shock you. And it was all just made up filth, pure, libelous, slanderous garbage. But it had the effect of planting a seed in the mind of a whole lot of Americans that Hillary Clinton could not be trusted. And so she has been in permanent defense mode since 1992. And if there was some sort of machine out there, Todd, you could not pay me. With all of her millions of dollars, you could not pay me to be her, to get up every morning and know that half of the people in your country hate your fucking guts. Who wants to live that way? Who would even want to be that kind of a president? Except for someone whose entire sense of self-definition and self-worth is the accession to power. And that is scary.
Well, you paint a picture of a Hillary Clinton who has a questionable medical history going forward in terms of that she's susceptible to a stroke at any point.
There's stuff out there, and I don't know the truth of it or the falsity of it, but there's a rumor out there that she had some sort of a head injury once upon a time in the fairly recent past. And she's 68 years old.
Oh, you mean when she was walking around with the dark glasses and they said she had a concussion and whatnot?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I don't even want to get it. I know other people want to talk to me, but I'm in South Carolina, and I'm going to tell you right now, it's frightening. The tension is, the Civil War is on. If you don't know it, you know it now, all right? The Civil War is happening. Boom, boom, boom. It's here. Folks are very... They're pulled in by this fascist, weirdo propagandist who's... He's up to no good. And, you know, and they're sucking up into it because he's just low-information folks. They don't want to know anything. They really don't care. They don't... Just like... I'm telling you, this was in the paper, our state paper, right after the primary, they said, well, you know, the KKK allegations, they don't bother us. No, not a big deal. So, now, I can't imagine that happening in 1978 when things were really starting to turn around when Carter was in. Because I remember when Reagan came in.
Hey, look, the last time South Carolina went for a Democratic nominee was Jimmy Carter.
Exactly. Let me tell you, this racial strife that we're dealing with was on the verge. It was really on. I remember this. I was a young teenager in 78. I really wanted to vote. I couldn't. But I was politically, you know, astute. And I could, you know, things were moving. But then as soon as he made that speech, it was like the race. When Reagan got in and pulled up in Mississippi, it was like, because I was living in the exoburbs, like you know, you got your suburbs, then you got past the suburbs, then you got like borderland, like rural. We just moved there, so of course there's not many black people there at all. But I was feeling, I could feel it, right? When Reagan came in, it was just ridiculous. So the reason I bring that up is that when I saw Trump's rally in Alabama, and these people were holding up the silent majority signs. I know what that means. the silent majority. All right, so you know what that means. If you don't know what it means, look it up. I'm just getting weary. I'm becoming weary. We should be past this. This is really serious. This is not productive. Because as you've been saying, and other people, I don't know when the neo civil war started, but we're in it. We are in it.
Well, how many years, Todd, have I been talking about the Cold Civil War?
You have been.
I invented that term.
And that's you. That's how brilliant you are. Brilliant. There's no way around it. See, people have. This is. We have to make a stand. See, this is why. The thing is, everything is all weird now. It's like we're on a ship and the water. You ever been out in a boat and the waves are coming from everywhere? They're not coming from one direction. Because we got now the world is blowing. The Middle East is blowing up. It's totally out of control. We're having our own civil war over here, right? It's just so much going on at once. That what are people to do? See, now they've got people in flux.
Yeah, a black kid in Roanoke got blown away by the cops the other day for carrying a BB gun.
Again. Oh, okay. Well, I just want to say I'm very disappointed in John Lewis. Maybe he got hit in the head too hard on that bridge.
No. Don't say that. Don't say that about John Lewis. No, John Lewis is up in his 70s. John Lewis has his, okay? John Lewis is a part, you know, he was a brilliant community activist. He was God knows he earned his stripes in the civil rights movement. But
the thing is,
if you get inside Washington long enough, in most cases, sooner or later, you will be pulled into its clutches. It takes a hell of a human being not to be. And that's one of those things that makes Bernie Sanders even more amazing. He's never abandoned his principles.
That's why I love him. It's not like I just got on the Bernie bandwagon and I started listening to him on his radio show.
Oh, God, millions of people have heard him on lunchtime with Bernie on...
Right,
over on Tom Hartman. Sure.
There you go, exactly. And see, I mean, I'm a type person, seriously. I think more, I mean, this is just me. I can't tell other people what to do, but when anybody, you know, in other words, I went to school for behaviorism. All right, reinforcement works. When people, punishment doesn't really work, but when people do something good, you need to let them know immediately. Even when, not even your congressperson, or any congressperson is making a good vote, call up and say, you know what, I really appreciate that vote. People need to know. And they know. That's why Bernie didn't know. He didn't know that he wanted to run. They had to beg him because people were calling. Because he was doing the right thing. And this goes into my last point. If you grab Bernie's popularity and his funding, now he's got no pack. And it's like one of these diesel locomotives, the old-timey steam locomotive, you know, the wheels spin at first and it's going like 3 miles an hour. It's like, this train's not going to go anywhere, right? No. Bernie's on the move. See, he got the South. The South is done. We need to just go ahead and cut it off now. Just give me my money. I'm out. But Bernie's on the move.
Well, I feel like a little bit of a hypocrite because I have spent a lot of time on this program talking about how tough it is to be a progressive in the Deep South, to be a liberal in the Deep South, to be a Democrat in the Deep South. And I maintain that. And I'm not going to back away from it. But for the life of me, I can't. Maybe it's true. You know, well, you know, people in the South just didn't know Bernie. Or maybe it's people in the Deep South don't trust a candidate who still talks like he's always talked all his life and doesn't put on a phony cornpone bullshit accent when they go down south.
Exactly.
I don't know, Todd. I don't know. But it's been a great conversation.
Thanks a lot, Bob, and doing a great job, and everybody contributing what you can.
Thank you kindly, Todd. Bye now. Calling from the home of American sedition. That's our buddy Todd. And before I go to the next call, and there is one on the line. Before I go to the next call, a note. At 9 minutes past the hour, we have raised zero this evening. We try to raise $200 every evening, and we are at zero. But courtesy of Ron in the far frozen north, we have a $75 challenge on the table, which, if met, will go a long way, a very long way, to alleviating that deficit and keeping us out of the hole. Thank you very, very kindly, Ron. So what is that, 15 at 5? Yeah. But, of course, the PayPal interface is at headonradionetwork.com. And there's a mailing address. And email me, bobkincaid@gmail.com, if you want the mailing address, because I want to make sure that we get over to what I presume to be Harry in Baltimore.
Yes, it is Harry.
Hey, Harry.
Hi, Bob.
What's up?
As they say on terrestrial radio, thank you for taking my call.
No, thank you for making it.
No, I was kidding. I always find it. Anyway, well, and because I know that that's not something that you need to be told, so, or that you don't need that kind of flattering. So I just meant that as a joke.
No, flatter. Yeah, I'm not feeling so good. It always helps.
Well, no, I'm just reminded of what goes on in terrestrial radio when all the callers, you know, feel they have to.
Yeah, I know. Mega Dittos from Busted Knuckle Rush. I love you. Thanks for taking my call. That's enough about you. Let's talk about me.
Yeah. Anyway, look, I'm going to try to keep this relatively brief. I know you've been talking for a long time, one person, and I hope you. What can I say? Anyway, thank you for taking my call, you know, right away. You could have easily taken a break, and I hope that you're not too... I'm sorry to hear about that you're not feeling well, and I hope you're not too...
Oh, I feel like crap, but, you know.
Well,
we'll
I'm very
through.
Sorry.
We'll get through.
And, you know, we need you in the long run, so I really hope you're not stretching... overextending yourself too much.
Oh, I'll get done with the program and I'll get horizontal so fast it won't even be funny.
You're very generous to try to go the whole 3 hours, and I don't want to put words in people's mouths, but I'm sure that many, many members of the Horn family appreciate your staying on the air. And I also did want to say, by the way, I wanted to really start off. And I suppose this is also a fundraising kind of reminder or push, but I really wanted to compliment you on what I thought was a very subtle and fine-grained analysis of the last 48 hours in terms of the primaries. I thought what you said, you know, was quite not only fascinating, but I think it, you know, brought out some things that people, including me, may not have seen or forgotten or didn't take seriously. And I think that needs to be said because, as you were saying, and this is sort of what I want to talk about, you know, the mainstream media is so, whether it's the reporters themselves or their bosses or the people who work in sales or whatever, the result is that the mainstream media, you know, wants to do these things in broad strokes, and those broad strokes, you know, are not nuanced. They're black and white. You know, there's nothing certain about them. They sound good, or they're, you know, something that they can say to sound authoritative, but they're not. And in particular, I did want to actually say that I really, in a sense, would like to sort of conduct a mini funeral for the New York Times, and may it rest in peace.
You've come not to praise the Times, but to bury it.
Yes, that's exactly what I feel.
Well, I mean, it's just kind of sad, Harry.
It's very sad.
I mean, you're reading the same stuff I'm reading, I presume.
I'm sorry?
You're reading the same stuff I'm reading. I mean...
Yes, I hope so. And also, I'm also getting stuff because, as you may recall, I have sort of a separate social policy activist, sort of small life in the world of single-payer health care. And I'm on some, actually, one or two closed listservs. And there's been, aside from what the New York Times has been saying about, doing, in a sense, to, I think, create, various kinds of false impressions of Hillary Clinton, there's also been a week or two ago, to also keep trying to, they did one very serious, what most people in the single-payer community consider a hit piece on Bernie Sanders, outline of a program for universal health care, because what they did was they had a reporter, she interviewed three economists, three. And it was all about how and one of them was actually this gentleman from, I think, Emory University, who is sort of, it's not clear, he in the past had done some very complimentary, economic studies of single-payer health care, but for some reason now is saying that, it can't be done. And it's, anyway, he was one of the three, and there was somebody else who then referred to, his involvement in what he called some lefty chat rooms. The whole thing, it was just very slimy piece. And the single-payer community and its allies, they came out right away and said, this is really an absurd piece. Yeah, they said it was
Harry, ridiculous. I mean, there's a question inherent there. Why, her stump speech changed last night, and she didn't have anything to say about Bernie. She was directing herself toward Trump. And she said, "We don't need to make America great again. America's always been great. We need to make America whole again." And I'm sure that's been focus grouped right into the ground.
I don't even know. But do you know what that means? Bob?
Not the first foggy clue.
That's what my point.
If I could, just to put this out there, food for thought, Harry.
Very sorry.
No, don't apologize. If America's great, why is it that we can't do a relatively simple thing that other industrialized nations all over the planet manage to get right? Why can't we do what Canada does? Why can't we do what the UK does, what Germany does to one degree or another, what France does to a certain degree, what the Swedes and the Norwegians and the Danes and the Finns and the Japanese and the Australians do? Why? What's wrong with America that we can't do it? Are we just that sunk deep into idiocracy? Is that what it is, Harry?
Why can't anybody ask that question? Was that a rhetorical question?
No, there's not a damn thing rhetorical about it.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Well, I'll tell you what. You actually asked me a related question, I think sometime last week, and it really stuck with me, and what you said last week was that you wish we could really get where you think, you were saying more that actually we needed to get to the roots of the American culture's really hatred or opposition to government, as a protective or positive force, and that we needed to get to the roots of that because it is so pervasive and it's so easily triggered. As in this election and in other elections as well. And I called to talk about the mainstream media and how they, in a sense, kind of really taint the culture with their the show. And this is actually, I was reading a book by a guy named Tim Weiss, and I'll say this, he's white, but he went to college in New Orleans and Tulane, and ended up, his first job after college was working for an organization that was trying to defeat David Duke and all of his kind of campaigns down there. And he recently wrote a book called The Under the Affluence. And this reason I mention it is because I myself this past weekend went to Baltimore's only, and it's true, free bookstore, and was trying to find, you know, ended up looking at trying to find books by historians about American, you know, the beginning of the United States and about America that would maybe explain the culture that somehow has led us to be, or that right now where we find there's so much anti-government, you know, dominance of that ideology. And I've been sort of poking, and I brought about literally about five or six books home in American history that I'd never read. And some of them by very prominent people, including Richard Hofstadter, it turns out, or some other interesting books. You know, you mentioned his essay in his book, Paranoid Style in American Politics, but he also did some other things that are less well known. And also even Gordon Wood, who, and this is not his famous book, which was about was sort of a radical interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. This was an earlier book he wrote when he was a much younger professor about the whole sort of American Revolution process. And I'm so far out on the ledge here, I don't mean necessarily, I'm even hesitant to say it, but what I get is, and there was another book, it was a very perceptive historian named Robert Wiebe, who is most known for not this book, but another book. But he did write a book called Self-Rule, the Cultural History of American Democracy. And I picked that up as well because I knew his other book, which is much more well-known. But anyway, he taught, well, a lot of these people are talking about the fact that the culture, in a sense, was never, may never have been really all of that amenable or that cordial towards government.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that, Harry.
Yeah, and maybe you have thought, and I know you probably thought this through much more than I have, and I'm just sort of here with kind of the, you know, the guy who went and looked for it, and I'm just kind of coming up for air and just giving very, 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 very preliminary sort
well, it's,
of, you
it's
know, kind of
it's kind
report
of like,
from the whole.
Yeah, it's kind of like why we have polling place laws about not electioneering. I mean, there are stories.
Right.
There are stories out of Appalachia of, you know, the brawls and fisticuffs that would transpire on election day because it was traditional for the candidate to bring a wagon load of liquor.
Yeah. Well, no, wait, so you're saying the polling laws, in other words, that they're anti-government? Is that what your point is?
Yeah, because, well, what I'm saying is that there's...
Or anti-voting?
There's a seething undercurrent.
Yeah.
Not just in the electorate, but in the folks seeking to be elected to control the outcome.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And that in itself is a manifestation of a distrust of government.
Yes. And so what I would sort of do is combine a lot, various things in the mix. And some of these I have emailed, you know, talked to you about an email about. I would mix together. Okay. So if we, okay, first of all, as a number of historians pointed out, in the colonies, you had different interpretations, for example, of the English law that they brought over, you know, from England. And not all of them, you know, used all of it, and not all of them used it in the same way. So there was, in general, this idea, well, we'll sort of take what we need, but the rest we're going to kind of leave behind. Because we really, really, in a sense, really, really don't want government. And there also seemed to be a lot of emphasis on order, not through government, but through religion, like, you know, the Puritans and other religious groups in other colonies. Okay, so then you have that. Then you have, as Dr. Bill has so, you know, pointed out so wonderfully all the time, the kind of almost, I don't know, well, I'm being polite, the ambivalence or maybe even the underlying hostility that the, you know, very well-off educated aristocrats who wrote the Constitution had towards, you know, real democracy, towards the people. And that even though the Federalist Papers sound so, you know, inspiring that, as Dr. Bill has said, that, you know, a lot of it, and other people too, you know, that a lot of it was propaganda because they needed to, once they had this draft Constitution, they needed to get it approved. Even though, in fact, it may not have been, in a sense, you know, particularly populist or even at all populist. Then you have this, you know, cultural thing, particularly among, and this is more maybe among, more among men, but this thing about rugged individualism. And from what I can tell, you know, that goes way, way back. I mean, Herbert Hoover, you know, wrote a turn, you know, gave a big speech about individualism. I think 1922 is considered, you know, one of these great American speeches, but it goes much farther back. And even if, you don't, and as I mentioned to you, I think in an email, you know, there, this man who studied, what he called the manhood in America cultural history, said that, you know, even in the late 1700s, there were these plays performed, before, you know, before the revolution in the colonies, let's say the mid 1700s, where this kind of rugged individualism idea and the idea of manhood sort of all being combined with that, that was all part of this early American culture. Then if you take that and you then look at what happened when Frederick Jackson Turner wrote his famous article in the late 1800s about the significance of the American frontier. And he says a lot, and I was just rereading that particular essay that he wrote about it recently, and he talks about the fact that as long as there was a frontier, you see, the fact is that people sort of, in a sense, going individualistic and proving themselves and proving their manhood, because it was, you know, I mean, sure, there were wives, yes, there were women and there were wives and spouses, but a lot of the, you know, decision-making, not all of it, but a lot of it was done by men. And if they were going to strike out, leave, you know, the more populated parts of even the colonies, it's going to be the men, because they were the ones at that time anyway who were supposed to be, you know, the breadwinners and head of the household and all that. So as long as, so Jackson Turner is saying, well, as long as the frontier was there, in a sense, this, you know, kind of rugged individualism really didn't, you know, destructively affect the culture, because in a sense it was being channeled into something that these people wanted or needed. But then he points out, but the problem is, once you get to the point where the frontier basically has been, you know, reached, there's no more, you know, there's nothing, nowhere else to go, then then you have a problem, because all these ideals, you know, about being, you know, rugged individualism and, you know, I can do this myself, or I'm going to move out to this, you know, new area where, you know, land is cheaper, even maybe be gotten for free, it doesn't have any place to go anymore. Then this book that I mentioned, this, Under the Affluence, just actually published last year, he points out how the media actually, despite the fact that, you know, the now we have this idea of meritocracy, and also we, and he says that in a sense he feels the media really keep it going, even though it probably has, whether it ever lived, but it certainly has died in, you know, recent years or decades. But he said that when the media, for example, put on reality shows, what are those shows about? They're not about cooperation. They're about competition, or people doing bad things to each other.
Dog eat dog.
Right, because, you know, like Survivor or anything else, it's everybody against everybody else. Everybody's trying to win. And then he quotes this female commentator, and she's talking about the fact, she says, she's talking about, for example, CNBC, and she says, in what might be a surprise to non-viewers, the network dedicates all 3 hours of prime time on Wednesdays to a show called Secret Lives of the Super Rich, where the 1% can learn everything from which firms specializing in super rich security, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So he then goes on from there to say that basically, and he's quoting another kind of ecological philosopher named Derek Jensen, who I hadn't frankly even heard of. But Jensen basically says, you know, if you are always competing against everybody else, well, how can you not have a culture of cruelty? Because the fact is that when you, you know, when in a sense you are told that everybody's competing against you, then you're going to feel, first of all, you may feel paranoid, but then you're going to, you yourself, here, this is what he says. If you believe the fundamental organizing principle of the world is competition, you will perceive the world as full of ruthless competitors, all of whom will victimize you if they get the chance. The world of you, as you perceive it, will begin to devolve into consisting entirely or almost entirely of victims and perpetrators. Those who do and those who get done to, the fuckers and the fucked. Pardon my Spanish. Your society will devolve, not in perception but in all truth, into these roles you have projected onto the world at large. You will begin to believe that everyone is out to get you, and why not? After all, you are certainly out to get them. And he's talking about, you know, the culture of business or, you know, economics and competing for jobs, et cetera. So I just have to believe that, in fact, and this is alluded to by some of these historians, that actually the era of FDR and Social Security and these few wonderful things that, you know, big government has given us, they may be, in a sense, you know, an anomaly. You know, and then in fact, before FDR, you know, we were kind of a disordered, unsettled place where, you know, a lot of rugged individualism was not only accepted, but was, you know, endorsed and encouraged. And after FDR, as I've mentioned to you, you know, there are scholars who now see how after FDR, there was a whole backlash from the right to try to make capitalism seem virtuous again, because it had been so disgraced in the Depression. But, you know, these people weren't giving up. So after the Depression, you know, they started societies. They ended up glorifying people like Hayek, who was maybe not quite the libertarian they wanted, but libertarian enough. He wrote a book called The Road to Serfdom, you know, which sounds very libertarian. And then the career of Milton Friedman also came out of these attempts, and a particular society that was founded in Switzerland after, you know, in the 40s, late 40s after World War II. So I just have to believe that, in a sense, the anti-government really, that's why we can't do these things, because we're hobbled by all of these messages and the mainstream media. And, you know, I'll include the New York Times in there, but they are persuading people that there's still some hope that they can also, you know, be rugged individualists and competitive. And there's some hope that they can still win and become millionaires and billionaires. And that, in fact, that's really just, you know, it's bait. It's just, it doesn't, you know, those TV shows are all slanted in that way, or most of them are. And, you know, even if you go back to the lives of the rich and famous, what's his name? The guy,
we went looking for the world's most famous bowl of soup. We found it in Japan. Yeah. Snake urine soup, $15,000 a bowl. I was watching that day.
Yeah, you're the radio person. No, I'll let you do
the Robin Leach. Oh, my God.
Yeah, Robin Leach. And, you know, so he's saying, we really have, you know, these cultural things are still being perpetuated. And the problem is, of course, is that most people, and, you know, and this has been certainly shown by sociologists, economics, you know, that actually mobility in the United States is actually less now than in other countries, some of the other countries you were talking about, who have, you know, universal health care, et cetera. And part of the reason, not all the reason, but part of the reason is that those people are freed from worrying about, you know, even let's say if they fail in business, they don't have to worry about whether they can still get health care or if they're going to go bankrupt because of a medical bill. But we just seem to be not willing to say that, in a sense, we need to be, have a different culture. It's too much. It seems like for many people, it's just too much. Or maybe it's part of the air. It's part of the climate. So maybe it's all false consciousness. But whatever it is, we're still doing it. And the mainstream media are still churning out these reality shows. And, you know, there's nothing in, or as far as I know, I've never heard of a cooperative reality show. Now, maybe there is one, but I've never heard of it. And I just, you know, and even primetime drama shows, you know, from what I hear, because as I've said, I don't watch TV, but what I read about them is, you know, these shows about people betraying each other, you know, in law firms and in politics and everything. And it's just like,
oh, it's all the way.
Shows?
Harry, it's all the way to dog eat dog over who can find the most ginseng in Appalachia. Okay.
Okay. Well, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know the ginseng whisperer.
Yeah. Oh.
No, really.
Are you kidding me?
No. No. He's
really?
No. He's a local celebrity because he's on the ginseng show.
But how is he competing? I mean, what's the competitive edge of the show?
Well, ginseng, you got to work your ass off to find it, and then then you got to get it to market, and and you know you got to trespass on people's land and these hillbillies and people shoot at each other and. Yeah. Oh my goodness gracious! It plays, Harry. But I'm gonna ask this before we conclude.
I take
your critique very very seriously, and it is most scholarly.
Well, it's very tentative.
Well, but I wonder if how can I put this? I wonder if we'd. If it were not for the fact that white people are if it were not for the fact that racism is so deeply ingrained all the way into our genetic makeup as a nation, I wonder if we would have an easier time getting something like universal single payer health care.
Because, well, I think you're right because actually,
whether it's Reagan talking about welfare queens. Or, you know, all the dog whistle codes, super predators, yada, yada, yada.
Well, no, Bob, you know, you are just so perceptive about this. This is again from this 2015 book by Tim Weiss called Another Affluence. This is what he says. It's very brief. He says, the history of whiteness as a wedge between working class people and as a key element of the perpetuation of economic inequity goes back to the early colonies in the Americas. And then he quotes someone discussing the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Basically, yeah, I mean, the answer is, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, I'm not going to read all this, but yes, they're basically, racism, in a sense, really also made it even worse, made the hobbling even worse because of the problems of class privilege, which were really actually racial privilege. And, collaborations, as he says, between poor Europeans and Africans and militant resistant economic oppression had frightened the Virginia planter class during Bacon's Rebellion 1676. It's too much to read, but I think you're absolutely right. This is yet another thing that we, you know, and, you know, social scientists around the United States have, as you know, have written about this for decades, about how this is, you know, racism basically contaminates everything that we try to do.
And you know, that leads to a second question, and this is the part that I don't understand. And I try to move ever so carefully in this inquiry because I don't want to let American racism burble over into my inquiry or be perceived in that light. But the states where I even object on a racial ethnic basis to the idea of people of color being referred to as any sort of noun, and the fact that the Clinton campaign refers to African Americans in the South as her firewall, anything that has a possessory in front of it in regard to the community of color is absolutely obnoxious and disgusting to me.
Oh, it is to me. I agree
with
you.
But all of these stand states, Harry, are places that are never ever, to quote Mrs. Clinton, going to get anything resembling universal single-payer health care unless we do something like what Bernie is talking about. Just as a for instance, you know, the Medicaid expansion was quashed in those states by John Roberts in what I think was a moment of true evil genius. I think John Roberts is an evil genius.
Oh, he's definitely
a very
smart man. No, he's been
he let the corporate welfare part of the ACA slide, but he stopped in its tracks, even though it was state administered by federal grants. He stopped in its tracks a form of universal single payer health care, you know, because the Medicaid expansion is universal single payer health care for the working poor, and he stopped that. And so, absent some sort of Medicare for all public option, the working poor, be they black or white, in Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Louisiana's going to get it, okay, but Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, South Carolina, they're never going to see it. And it's not like the political leadership of those states are ever going to, you know, come around and say, oh, well, you know, everybody needs health care. Bullshit. They're never going to do that, Harry. And so that's what I don't understand about voting for somebody who tells you you're never, ever going to have something that you desperately need. I don't understand it. Maybe someone can explain it to me. But it absolutely just beats cat's bucket as far as I'm concerned.
Well, all I can tell you is that at one point Tim Wise talks about a study where basically people were given a description of a very significant health care reform plan. Some of the people were told it was Bill Clinton's plan, and some people were told it was Barack Obama's plan. And you can probably guess what the responses were.
Oh, and I'm sure it was statistically significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, in other words, and as he says, research found that whites who scored high on measures of racial resentment, for example, believing that blacks get more than they deserve from the government, were the most likely to alter their perception of the proposal when thought it was Obama's as opposed to Clinton's. So he concludes, in other words, white opposition to national safety net programs, from health care to cash assistance to nutrition aid and housing assistance, is shaped by the perception that the beneficiaries will be mostly people of color and thus undeserving. And there,
we have to remember that when Social Security was introduced,
right,
it had to be introduced without access to it for people of color.
Yeah.
Tells a lot.
And he says this, you know, persists even though, in fact, you know, that the data basically says, does not, you know, corroborate that. So,
well, Harry, anyway. I do need to roll because I want to get a couple more calls
in. Yes, absolutely.
But it has been a lovely conversation. It always is. I always wind up feeling a little bit more intelligent after our conversations than before they start.
Oh, no. Well, I'm still working on this, but I do think this anti-government thing really runs much deeper than even I thought. And it may be, that's maybe why we're so hobbled by, you know, and also maybe why we almost defensively have to say that we're an exceptional great nation.
And you know what? We may also have to just come to the point where we look up and go, we're never going to get well. I mean, that's what the presidential election of either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump will mean to me. We're never going to get well.
I think I understand what you're saying, and of course I'm still praying that Bernie Sanders is going to win, and we're going to change direction.
I understand. And look, I mean, I want to be clear. You know, at least she won't appoint Scalia Jr. to the court. So, you know, I got that going for me.
Yeah.
One last thing before we go, just for your consideration. Have you run across a story about what a miserable racist prick fat dead Tony Scalia was when he was a law professor at the University of Chicago and the University of Virginia?
I saw a little bit of that. I didn't.
There was one class where every student of color in the class always failed.
No, that I had not seen, although I just heard general, discussion about it. But no, I did not know that. And I'm not surprised, based on what we, know about his attitudes and, even what he has said in his either dissents or,
I got a feeling if you check the Goodwills or the Salvation Armies or whatever, now that his closets have been cleaned out, I'll bet there's a goddamn Kleagle's robe.
I'm sorry, a what?
A Grand Kleagle's robe.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe it's Knights of Columbus, whatever, yeah.
Well, I told you what Michael Dukakis said about him when they were in law school, and he said to an interviewer recently, he was to the right of Marie Antoinette, for Christ's sakes. That's a literal quote, I believe. So.
All right, Harry, have yourself a good evening.
Yeah, you too. Thank you so much.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye now. Our buddy Harry calling from Baltimore. It's quarter before the hour. I've made it through almost the entire program. Yay! And we got one more caller on the line. Before we go there, though, I want to bring something up. The challenge is now up to $85, thanks to Steve in New York. And with that on the table, I'm happy to say that almost half of it has been met by our buddy, the Angry Architect. Thank you very kindly, Angry. It is much appreciated indeed. So we've got, $45 more dollars to meet the challenge put up by Ron in the Frozen North and Steve in New York. And that'll get us to three-fourths of the way to our fundraising goal for the evening, if it gets met. $45 to go on the challenges and $95 to go to finish off fundraising for the evening. Thank you very, very kindly. Remember, Odd Change gets rounded up. Thank you, Harold. Thank you. And let's run over and talk to Flavio. Hey, Flavio.
Hey. Ground rules. You set the ground rules. I'm your guest.
We don't. Rules? We don't need no stinking rules.
No, but apologies are in order. I've been having some health issues, but
sorry to hear it.
Not to belabor, and so I apologize for my telephonic reticence, shall we say?
I understand.
And two items caught my mind tonight. But a third crept into my mind, as it always does, because it's always bristling. I wish I could shut it down somehow. No, I'm kidding. I'm not insinuating anything. But the whole thing about I really do believe that Norman Goldman is right about one thing. We don't play Smash Mouth. When we progressives fight for our causes, we don't.
We bring the tambourines and the kazoos and the guitars and hope that we can play Kumbaya to.
Yeah. And the other side is like gunning for our throats. And we want to bring the guitars, the kazoos, the harmonicas. I have a honer. And they expect that everybody will smoke the peace pipe. And can I bring George Lakoff into the discussion?
By all means.
Scientist?
Absolutely.
The whole problem is framing. The other side is awesome. Friggin' awesome.
Yeah, this all goes back to don't think about an elephant.
At framing, they are awesome. And this is what they'd reduced us to. Kilkenny cats. There once were two cats of Kilkenny. Each thought there was one cat too many. So they fought and they fit. And they scratch and they bit. Till accepting their nails and the tips of their tails, instead of two cats, there weren't any. And that's what they've reduced us to. They've reduced us to gnawing, clawing at each other. Okay?
Yeah.
So, think about that. Now, think about this. Okay? I wanted to bring two other issues. The toxicity of the current Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton's managerial, I don't like that word. It's a good word. Lust for power is more like it, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of Chaucer's, I can't remember which one. Where does this come from? The root of all evil is greed. It's been mistranslated forever.
Oh, that comes from the Old Testament. The love of money is the root of all evil.
Yeah, no. But it's been mistranslated. What it really means is radix malorum est cupiditas. It means the root of all evil is cupidity or covetousness or greed. And greed can come in many forms. It can be the greed for money, possessions, power over people, land, you name it, okay? And why did I mention that? Oh, we'll come back to it. Okay, so DNC chair joins GOP attack on Elizabeth Warren's agency. This is from the Huffington Post.
Oh, I read that, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, Debbie Wasserman Schultz is...
Yeah, gunning for Elizabeth Warren's Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Yes.
Defunding it, submitting a bill to the effect that it would coddle the financial services industry. And I have so many friends that have been taken hook, line, and sinker by these payday loan schemes, right?
Right, which...
And title loans, car loans, okay?
Yeah.
Can I divagate?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, La Crosse, I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Little town, about 50,000. Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful. If you're ever here,
I will
take you all over the place, and I'll show you this place. It is god-awfully beautiful. It's like Switzerland. To me, it's like Switzerland. It's like, wow, beautiful. Anyway, there used to be... when I used to have to do heavy laundry, there used to be a laundromat down the street from me, a couple blocks. And another couple blocks the other way. You know what has supplanted that?
I can only guess.
Payday loans.
Sure. Did y'all have those before Scott Walker?
That was even before Scott Walker.
I know they're on every when I get back down to Alabama. I know they're on every goddamn corner.
They're in every freaking goddamn corner.
The thing is, we have to understand where it's not like somebody just takes their pension money and says, "Muriel, let's open up a payday lending shop."
And these aren't even black people, okay? I'm living in little Scandinavia. They're mostly white people here, okay?
Yeah. But the big banks are behind it. The same people who trashed the economy in the early aughts are behind payday lending because they want it all.
They want it all.
And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is trying to tank Elizabeth Warren's law. That would, to coin a phrase, bring them to heel.
And I apologize, I don't call so often. It had something to do with the snob of a speech professor at the UW. University of Wisconsin La Crosse, who corrected me mid-sentence. He said, no, it's not to err is human. It's to err is human. Go fuck yourself. Can I swear? I'm sorry.
Absolutely. The FCC has no jurisdiction.
I said,
here.
I just lost it. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? We're in the Midwest. We have a different accent. You know, this guy was like such a snob, and to this day I have a problem. I even have a slight stutter when I speak publicly.
Don't feel bad. I stutter all the time.
I am not good at public speaking, but I was so mad. But that's why I don't call. I'm always afraid. I don't know why. I'm among friends. I it's stupid, I know. So I apologize. But getting back to the subject at hand. So this is why Hillary Clinton is a friggin' weasel. And I just loved Samantha Bee's take on it. Did you see that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, if you think she's flip-flopping now, in the general election, she'll be somersaulting. I was just, like, laughing my butt off. This is on YouTube. You can look it up. Samantha Bee is, she reminds me of a girlfriend in college I had that used to slap my butt and smoke cigarettes in the mezzanine and was just an all-out riot and just fun to be with. This is like, oh my God. But, and then the power thing. I once worked for a law firm. Okay. 2 weeks.
Makes two of us.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. A whole 2 weeks. This power trip of a lawyer expected me, I'm just a clerk, okay? I type very well. I type, I'm going to say, 60 words a minute.
I hate to say it, but you're going to have to talk faster. Because we're running out of time, Flavia.
Yeah. And she expected me to arrange her entire office. And she just made me cower. And she was just one hell of a power trip, and I'm glad I never got bit by the power trip bug. But the whole point I was saying is those people make the world toxic. I'm glad I have any control over myself. That's hard enough. I don't want to control anybody else. I don't want to control anybody else's affairs. Thank you very much. And that's what I wanted to say. I just, like, yeah, she let me go after about 2 weeks, and then one of her underlings tried to contact me to get my info so that he could slice me a check. And I told him to tell her to go stuff it. This was in Madison, way back. I'm talking 20, 25 years ago, something like that. But I always remember that. You there?
Right here.
Okay, your turn.
Well, no, we just have to wrap up, Flavio, and that's really all there is to it. I hope you're feeling better.
No, I'm feeling great. No, but burn, baby, burn.
Yep.
I love you, man, and. As soon as I can, I'll be sending some sunshine your way.
Bless your heart, Flavio. Thank you very kindly. You have a good evening.
Likewise.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy Flavio calling from Wisconsin. And Glory, I've made it through 3 hours, and we'll do it again tomorrow. Thorn in the Side Thursday comes your way, our way, tomorrow with what I think will be particularly interesting conversation. Thank you for all the well wishes. I appreciate it. Hopefully this is a 24 or 48 or not much more than, you know, 72 hour bug and yuck. But it's about time to go and
chew up a few more ibuprofens for the refreshing burst of flavor. Y'all have a wonderful evening, and remember, we've got $45 to go to meet Ron and Steve's challenge, and $95 to go to finish fundraising for the evening. Thank you very, very much. Have a wonderful evening. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Everyone. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.